Money FM 89.3, best of prime time.
You're listening to Prime Time on Money FM 89.3. I'm Rachel Kelly. China's exports unexpectedly rose in June as overseas economies reopened after lockdowns, while imports grew for the first time this year, reinforcing views that the recovery from the pandemic is gaining traction in the world's second largest economy. Exports in June edged up 0.5% from a year earlier, beating analysts' expectations for a 1.5% drop. Imports also gained some ground, up 2.7%, confounding market expectations for a 10% drop. And to find out more and what this means for China's economy, we're joined by Mr. Tommy Jie, head of Greater China Research at OCBC Bank. Tommy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So first, can you tell us, what do you make of the latest trade numbers?
Yeah, sure. I think there's quite a couple of interesting takeaways from the latest numbers. If you look at the exports, so we do see a small rebound of the exports. So I think one of the interesting takeaways from the export number was China's trade surplus with the U.S., in particular in terms of the goods trade surplus. Despite the trade war between China and the U.S., seems like the China's exports to the U.S. remain quite resilient. So as a result, we do see the trade surplus between China and the U.S. actually continue to widen for the past 1 to 2 months. I think in June alone, so we almost have about $30 billion U.S. dollar trade surplus between China and the U.S. So that's quite a significant amount, which we can see. So other than the export numbers, we also see a quite strong recovery of the import stories. So if we look at the underlying breakdown of those import figures, I think there are two major contributing factors to the strong rebound of the imports for June. I mean, the first one is that we do see quite a strong demand for the iron ore imports. So that may be due to China's, you know, increasing in all the investment projects, which require a lot, you know, inputs from the iron ore. I mean, the second is also we are seeing quite a strong import number of the electronic integrated circuits. Mm. I think that's usually the key, you know, element for the electronic sectors. So I think that's probably because of two reasons. I mean, the first reason, we do see, you know, the recovery, you know, in China. So I mean, globally, I think the demand for the electronic product is still quite high despite the pandemic. So that actually also, you know, translating to a stronger demand for all those, you know, the supply chain kind of the stories. So, I mean, the second reason is also maybe because China is still preparing for the worst between the, you know, U.S. and the China relationship. That's why they try to stock up more electronic integrated circuit. I mean, just in case they got really out of supply from the U.S. and also other markets. I think those are all the regions, you know, contributing to the quite a strong trade number, in my opinion.
So where are we with the U.S.-China trade war at the moment? I mean, aside from the trade war, we've also seen that China's imposed sanctions on a group of U.S. lawmakers in retaliation for measures announced by Washington last week over alleged human rights abuses. What's happening, Tommy? What's the latest?
Yes, I mean, what we are seeing is two interesting angles. I mean, the first angle is that we're still seeing the very similar tit-for-tat kind of the story. But of course, it's not like in terms of the trade war as what we saw last year. So now it's more like a tip for tat for all the measures U.S. imposed on China. For example, just now you mentioned the sanctions on the individuals. I think this latest announcement from China was just like reaction to U.S. announcement on that. So I don't think this is going to have a very significant impact on those individuals. I don't think that those individuals are going to come to China anytime soon. I don't think they're going to hold the renminbi assets anyway. But of course, it's just sending a signal is that China is ready for more conflict potentially. So I think that seems like it's one of the key angles right now between the U.S. and the China relationship. So other than that, we're also seeing more and more elements. So I think for this year, bilateral relationship between the U.S. and China seems like more complex as compared to last year. I mean, last year seems like it's simple. It's much simpler, right? Because we only talk about the trade war between the U.S. and China. But I think for this year, other than trade war, we have the pandemic issue, we have the Hong Kong situation. So we do have more elements coming into, you know, joining this tension. I think yesterday, we also heard more news headlines regarding the U.S. position in the South China Sea. So, I mean, those are all going to contributing, you know, to all those kind of the tension in the coming months. But interestingly, I think the impact on the market so far is still quite limited. I would say it's still quite muted because what US has been doing is fairly measured. So we are not going to see very significant impact on the economy and the financial market for the moment.
I just want to go back to the trade numbers that were out today as well. And we've also got China's GDP expected out this week. Are you expecting better than forecast numbers on the back of what we've seen with these trade numbers out today?
Right. I think for GDP, it's still a bit tricky, in my opinion. So, okay, I mean, first of all, my sense is that we definitely are going to see quite a strong recovery in terms of the quarter-on-quarter growth. So, which means sequentially, I think we should see a very strong pickup from here in the second quarter. But the problem is, about, are we going to see a positive number in terms of a year-on-year reading? Are we going to see a negative number in terms of a year-on-year reading? So I think that's the part I'm still not quite particularly sure. I mean, my own estimation is we should expect maybe the range about 8 to 10% Q-on-Q growth for China. So, but that may potentially translate to around 0% to 2% kind of the range of in terms of the year-on-year. So one of the key uncertain part is what's the impact of the mini outbreak in Beijing on the consumption in June, because we do, there's like a mini outbreak in Beijing. So I think this event, even though if we look back right now, seems like it's quite limited impact. Right? I mean, we only got about 300 over cases from Beijing, but psychologically, I think the impact on the overall economic activity in China was quite huge, I would say, because people are really quite scared, what could be the next step. But now looking back, looking in July, it looks like it's okay. I mean, China is doing quite well to handle the pandemic. But back to June, I think people are quite concerned about this thing. That's why I think the consumption part could be one of the weakest link for the second quarter GDP. So that's why I think we cannot totally rule out, the risk for a very small marginal, decline in terms of the year-on-year numbers. So we will see on Thursday.
I mean, you've mentioned the fresh wave in Beijing. How concerned are you about the additional waves that we're seeing globally? I mean, also in Hong Kong as well.
Yes, I think now second wave seems like quite a big problem right now, whether it's in the US or in Asia. I mean, even like in Japan, in Tokyo, we do see the kind of the second wave, of course, in Hong Kong. But I mean, personally, I'm not in Hong Kong, so I cannot comment too much about Hong Kong situation. But of course, one of the things we can look at is look at the Beijing's experience, how they handle the second wave, right? I think it seems like Beijing is able to contain the outbreak within 1 month successfully. So I think for the past more than 1 week, so Beijing has already reported about zero confirmed case. So I think one of the lessons really we can learn from the Beijing's handling of this second wave is so-called the mass testing, right? So I think Beijing has really employed this mass testing model. So I think within like 2 weeks, Beijing tested more than 8 million people. So I think if you test earlier, you are able to identify earlier, you are able to treat earlier. So I think you are able to control the damage from this kind of the mini outbreak. So I think from the Hong Kong perspective, I think one of the things they are thinking right now is, should they go down, go down the same path of what Beijing did to go for the mass testing kind of the model? But of course, they may need they may need help from the central government if they really want to go down to this mass testing capacity kind of the model. But in my opinion, that is potentially could be one of the very effective model to contain the second wave kind of the outbreak.
In your research report, you spoke about the rally that we're seeing in Chinese markets at the moment. And we saw the Shanghai Index ending last week up by more than 7% and the Shenzhen Composite also gaining close to 10%, outperforming the 4% gain in the Nasdaq. Can you tell us what was driving the rally last week? I mean, markets are a little bit more muted today, but what's happening?
Right. I think from the macro perspective, so we do see quite a number of factors supporting the rally in China, in China's equity market in general. I mean, for example, in terms of the Chinese data, I think most of the numbers are still quite steady, I would say. So, I mean, China does benefit from this first-all kind of the recovery story at the moment. I mean, other than the growth story and Just now we talked about the Beijing outbreak. I think the way how China handled the second wave seems like it's quite successful at the moment. So that this also reinforced the people's confidence in government's capability to handle any mini outbreak in future. So I think that is also quite important sentiment right now to support the market. And also in terms of the U.S.-China tension, yes, there's a lot of headline news about that. There's a lot of noises about that. But in the end, the impact seems quite limited because most of the measures from the U.S. are still quite measured, in my opinion. So that's why I think we don't see like a big shock from the U.S.-China tension to this, in particular to the financial markets. I mean, those are all the key factors right now. Seems like a running to play a role, you know, in supporting the overall sentiment in China, right?
But how different is this from 2015? Because we did see a Chinese equity frenzy back then, and it ended in bad shape. Is this the start of a structural bull market in China?
Yes, that's really a million-dollar question people are really asking. So I think we have gone through the experience in 2015. So what we are seeing right now, we do see, you know, the turnover has soared, the margin financing is on the rise again. So that actually makes us a little bit concerned. Are we going to see the similar kind of the leverage driven kind of the boom bust scenario again? So everybody is looking for, we call is this time different kind of the factors. I mean for myself, if I try to find out, you know, whether this time is different or not. So one of the potential factors I personally observe is China's commitment to the capital market reform. So this one to me could be one of the potential, I would say that this time is different factors, because we know back in April this year, China came out a very important reform we call the production sector reform. So that's basically the extension of the supply side reform. So I think among this so-called factor reform, there are six important factors which is going to drive the long-term growth for China. So that including number one is the labor factor, number two is the land factor, number three is the technology factor, you know, number four is like just now we talk about the capital market factor, and also like entrepreneurship and the data. I think those are very important six factors. Among all, so one of them is the capital market reform. So of which the equity market reform is really holding the key right now. So I think if we look at the equity market reform, so I do sense there are three potential changes in the coming months and the quarters. I mean, the first change is really in terms of the IPO mechanism. So in the past, we know China is usually go for this approval-based IPO. If you want to get a company to be listed, you need to get approval from the government. That's not so effective, I would say. But now they are trying to move away from that approval-based to the registration-based. So that's one of the key factors supporting the sentiment right now.
That said, we've also seen a record high of 22 firms delisted in the first half of the year. This is a sign of cleaning up the market, right? And are we expecting to see more?
Right. Yes. I mean, we do. In terms of the delisting, I think that's another important. So I think the delisting story, I think to me, is very important because that's the point pointing towards more transparency and the more openness of the capital market. Because we know for the capital markets, so the foundation is the trust. Well, the trust is building on the transparency and openness. So in the past, you know, the problem in China is that you have a lot of lousy company, but it's a bit difficult to kick them out of the exchange because you have so many vested interests behind. So now with this improvement of this delisting mechanism, so you are able to deliver or present a more transparent, a more open capital market to the investors.
Well, Tommy, thank you so much for your insights. We've been speaking with Tommy Jia, Head of Greater China Research at OCBC Bank.
To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download the SBH radio app available on Google Play or the App Store.